Hello, everybody, and welcome to Truth Be Told. Today, I am honored to be joined by a very special guest, Mr. Russ Ramsey, who is a pastor and author of the book we're going to be talking about today called Rembrandt is in the Wind. Mr. Ramsey, could you introduce yourself to our viewers and just tell us a little bit about what you do and maybe even a little bit about what led you to write this book?
Yeah, so I'm a pastor in Nashville, Tennessee, on the south side, the Franklin side of town, and an author who have written six books. Three of them are about biblical literacy. They're sort of narrative tellings of the story of Scripture. One is memoir, and then two are about the stories behind some of the world's most celebrated and some unknown art. Which has been a passion of mine for, gosh, since I was in high school. I dedicated Rembrandt is in the Wind to my middle school and high school art teachers as people who helped form in me and in their students just an ongoing love for art, which remains very much with me to this day. So, so that's what I do. I'm a husband and father and writer and pastor here in Middle Tennessee.
That's great. Teachers are so incredibly important. Sometimes even I will undervalue. You know, I look back. My favorite thing to do in the world is read, which is actually how I came across your book. So I look back at like my kindergarten teacher who taught me, and I'm like, man, I need to be so much more grateful to her because they really do start us on paths sometimes that lead to things that are so much greater than just the first thing they teach us, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
So in the beginning of your book, you kind of break into this session because essentially what you're doing in the book is you're discussing art and artists through the lens of faith, and you're telling their stories and bringing out certain theological points. And just really, if a person is Christian, they'll appreciate the art. If a person is an artist, they'll appreciate the faith. You know, it's like you can come at this from two different ways and you grow in your appreciation for either side. But in the beginning, you're talking a lot about beauty and the importance of it. And I would love if you could just maybe walk us through that topic a little bit, because I do think beauty is so important, and yet something that in some ways we overinflate and in some ways we really devalue. So could you talk about the importance of beauty, especially in a life of faith?
So, I mean, for me, it really starts with this really simple idea of if you want to know God, then you have to be somebody who engages with splendor and wonder and glory. And beauty is one of the ways that we do that, you know, that we move into kind of the realm of the transcendent when we engage with beauty for beauty's sake. And we're really, you know, we're the only creatures, as image bearers of God, we're the only creatures on the planet who intentionally go places simply to behold beauty, to be in its presence. We, you know, and so for me, that's such a huge part of it is that we have in the West, especially, become such a pragmatic culture where things have to have kind of a desired outcome in order to justify our engagement with them. And beauty defies that. We engage with beauty for the sake of engaging with beauty. And, you know, it doesn't put money in our bank accounts. It doesn't advance our careers, but it works on our souls and it teaches us what it means to be human beings, living in a world that is filled with and reflects, the glory of the one who made it all. And so for me, that's a big part of it is I'm a pastor in a denomination that can be rather heady, sometimes and theologically very precise. And, you know, part of a Protestant denomination where, you know, the whole Protestant Reformation, one of the things that was kind of a hallmark of the Protestant Reformation in Europe was moving away from art, and moving away from visual representations of art for some good reasons and other reasons that I'm just like, I sure wish we didn't do that. But for me, it's a matter of trying. If you want to understand the world as it is, if you want to understand the person who made it, the one who made it as he is, and if you want to understand your own place in this world, then engaging with wonder and splendor and beauty, and leaning in with our hearts, and intentionally cultivating things like longing and desire, it is essential to being a human being as we were made. And so that's a lot of what drove me with this book was wanting to transcend this idea that we have, which is an unfortunate thing, that to engage with art, we have to have some sort of academic credential. We need to either be art history majors or people who are willing to do a deep dive into the technical aspects of art history and art appreciation. And one of the functions of this book for me was to try to defy that for people and say, it's okay. If you're not an art history major, I wasn't an art history major. I'm just somebody who's been paying attention to art for 50 years and I love it. And that's a very valid form of art criticism, is to stand in front of a painting and say, man, I love this. Or I don't get this. You know, those are both fair things. And so, and the way that I do that in the book, is really coming at it, in the most common language, people speak. And that is the language of story. They're just stories. I tell the stories about these artists and their works, and they're just fascinating. Nobody has a simple story.
Yeah. I think it's interesting that you connected the image of God that we all bear with the pursuit of beauty. Because so often, like you said, the Western mind, even in messages I've given in church, it's like, I'll go to, well, God gave us the ability to think and to reason. It's like, that's all true. And I think that is part of bearing the image of God. But so often with that empirical mindset, we leave out, or are in danger of leaving out, we pursue beauty unlike anything else in the world, like he did when he created all things. And you talk a lot about creation at the beginning of your book. I think the ending of that chapter says something like, beauty flows through the cracks and it speaks of the glory that's beyond it. And we're made for glory, like that mm-hmm. overwhelming, powerful glory. I just think that is such a beautiful image
yeah.
that we need to remember. If we want to be like God, that's a thing that we should pursue. It's a good thing.
Yeah, I describe it in there as I call it a relic of Eden. That beauty is a relic of Eden. It's something that was there before the fall, in an uncorrupted way. And whenever we're engaging with beauty, we're engaging with something that predates the fall of mankind and humankind. And I think that that's whenever we're able to do that, whenever we're engaging with something that existed before the fall, uncorrupted, is a very worthy pursuit for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, something that God's preserved for us. And I mean, how grateful should we be that God has, against all odds, preserved such incredible things
as a way to know him.
Yeah. Right. And not even just in nature, but allowed us to kind of partake in creation as well as beings that reflect him. Mm-hmm. I think that's just an incredible thing. Well, so we talked a little bit about, you talked about your Protestant background and how it came out of a period where, you know, especially like the early Catholic Church was very much into these grand cathedrals, and you visit them today and they're stunning. And mm-hmm. I do agree, we've lost something in going away from that taking pride in our work, physically speaking. But there are good reasons for, you know, some of our removal from that as well. So how would you respond to a person that might have misgivings around this idea of beauty, not for any sort of mm-hmm. Like ethereal reason, but more for a theological reason of they're looking back to a time when maybe people were too obsessed with like idol worship, or even currently we look at a world that is very image obsessed mm-hmm. and we kind of mistake that for beauty. So how would you respond to a person who thinks that way?
Well, you know, it was, In a lot of ways, I actually was raised Catholic, so I have a bit of a background with being in these ornate cathedral type of situations, which I absolutely love. I think we look back on some, you know, like Renaissance art, when we think about people like Michelangelo and Da Vinci and some of the great painters that and sculptors that adorn Italy everywhere you look. Mm-hmm. That when you see them, one of the things that when from our vantage point, these are classic artists, but during their era, in some ways, they were pop stars. Right. Some of the famous storytellers of their day, and churches competed to have the up and comers featured prominently as a way of getting people to come to their churches and give money to their building programs and support and promote their objectives. And so, you know, the Protestant Reformation was kind of attacking that whole idea of building a church that is directly connected to the accumulation of wealth and power. Right. And that sort of thing, which that all makes sense. But in the process of saying, okay, but then let's distance ourselves from art, we distance ourselves from one of the primary ways that we learn truth, and that is through storytelling. And, you know, Jesus' primary method of teaching during his earthly ministry, at least that's recorded in Scripture, is parables. He was a storyteller, and he relied on the function and the imagination that goes into listening to stories to convey truth that transcended just a three-point topical sermon. So, you know, even Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, which is this, you know, kind of repository of all these different things that we know Jesus to have said, it ends with a story. And it ends with a story that is intended to sit with the person who's hearing it and leave with them and make them kind of think about it. It ends with Jesus talking about there was a man who built his house on the rock and the waves came and the winds blew and it stood. And then there was a man who built his house on the sand. And when all those things came, it fell with a great crash. And that was the end of the sermon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and what he's doing is he's making you imagine the house, the sand, the man, the weather, the crash, and think about the consequences of these little decisions that we make along the way and the reasons that we make them, and how it is that we're moving through the world. And he's doing this by way of telling stories, and art is storytelling. Fundamentally, that's what it does, is it tells our story back to us. And mm-hmm. So, you know, a lot of these, for example, our church right now is, we're spending a little bit of time with Caravaggio's painting, The Incredulity of St. Thomas, where Jesus is guiding Thomas's finger into the wound in his side. And it's a very graphic painting. And I remember seeing it as a child and thinking, I don't know if I'm allowed to see this. Like, am I supposed to see this painting? Which made me just want to study it and understand it. But in that painting, it's not just that Caravaggio is kind of painting a picture of Thomas sticking his hand into the wounds of Christ. Caravaggio is interpreting that scene in the way that he composes his composition. And so he's making a lot of comments to us, the viewer, about this scene in the way that he puts it together. And that is one of the functions of art, is you're never just looking at a painting of something. You're looking at a message that an artist has composed in order to tell the viewer what the meaning is and the significance is behind what they're seeing. And that is a very important part of how we learn and how we grow and how we move through this world, is by hearing other people's responses to these fundamental truths and these basic stories. And so we're all drawn to that. It's why we go to movies. It's why we listen to songs. It's why we read books and look at art and sit around in the evenings with friends and tell stories, is because it's not just that they're funny or they're entertaining. It's that they carry significance about our meaning and our purpose for even being here. And so art is an important way for us to do that. That's different than a lot of other forms of learning and synthesizing the reality of living in this world that we're in.
That's such a good point. I think that some people that might be a little more skeptical would look back at the time and think, well, I understand they weren't as literate back then. They needed these visual representations of things. And so there's a value in that regard. And you brought that out beautifully in your book, which I think I didn't fully appreciate before, just how purposeful a lot of these things were. But to then bring that into the modern times and say, well, you know, I can read, so I don't really need it. But mm-hmm. the way you explain that, like, it's not just a painting, it's a message. And it's not even a message you have to accept. It's one you dialogue mm-hmm. with, in a way. And it's the same way you do with stories with friends or in music. Thankfully, we didn't lose music, you know, over time. Like, it seems like churches, whatever direction they went, they kept music, which I'm so grateful for, because that's a form of art that I think is so, so important. But you're expressing that art like paintings and sculpting can do a lot of the same things that we see the value in conversation and storytelling and music. So why cut off some of it just because you don't like how someone used it once along the way? That just seems ridiculous.
Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the things that I was so drawn to in writing this book, and I'm this way with music too, especially as some of my favorite musicians, are in their later years now, you know, is I really love, I'm fascinated by not just looking at a painting, but looking at a body of work. Like, what is the body of work that Rembrandt gave us, that Van Gogh gave us, that Edward Hopper gave us, who I write about in the book? You know, it's not just, I love this painting, or I think this painting is interesting, or this painting moves me. It's that over the course of their career, they give you a body of work, like Paul Simon. Paul Simon's body of work as a songwriter is a fascinating commentary on hubris and on arrogance and on humility and on suffering. And the swagger that he had when he was in his 20s, and the circumspection that he has now in his 70s, I guess, is really revealing when you look at the body of work as a whole. And so I'm fascinated by that, because these artists and painters and sculptors that are household names, for many of them, they had long careers, and the work that they made in the beginning tells a different story than the work that they make toward the end of their lives. And one of the common threads that runs through it is suffering, is they suffer and they're broken. And so all of the things that they, you know, were kind of flexing with early, sort of gives way to, usually gives way to a greater simplicity, and a more focused message mm-hmm. than what they were trying to do maybe in the beginning. Rembrandt's totally this way, where when you look at some of his earlier works when he was 24, 25 years old, it's amazing. Like, it's dazzling what he was able to accomplish. But then you look at the stuff that he made when he was older, and it's just intimate, and it's not as intricate. And that's not because he was necessarily because he was just older and is, you know, he couldn't do the fine detail work that he did when he was a younger man. It's mm-hmm. because he suffered. And he suffered tremendously and lost everything. And there's an intimacy that creeps into his work over time that you can tell is born out of sorrow. It gets sadder, and it gets more personal, and it gets more specific. And I love that kind of thing, because then it's not just this painting is saying something, but this individual who lived their days on this earth doing this thing where God had given them a special set of skills, you know, the ability to render onto a canvas scenes that we read on pages of a book. Rembrandt is such a good example of somebody who just changes before us. And so much of the change is observably spiritual, in the way that he's humbled and broken.
That art of looking at a collection of works rather than one is kind of being lost over time. I think even me, like, I'll listen to Spotify, and it's rare that I'll listen through a full album, let alone a full discography from an artist, you know, mm-hmm. or even paintings. It's like, we don't have as many galleries of one painter. We've got Google Images to select our favorite one and set as our home screen or something, you know?
Right. Yeah, Van Gogh is a good example of an artist that I think he's one where most people, when they look at Van Gogh, they're looking at a body of work more than they're looking at an individual painting. Right. I mean, people see Starry Night and they're like, okay, there's Van Gogh's Starry Night. But it's hard to separate the man and his story and his mania and his episode of cutting off his ear and his just sort of the story of who he was. And so, so you look at sunflowers and you look at irises and you look at Starry Night and you look at, you know,
even his self-portraits,
and it's all part of the same, you know, they're all just tracks on a record, you know, and the bigger record is one of somebody who is trying to find something, desperately trying to find something, and show it back to us, and struggling to do so.
Yeah, you mentioned that brokenness before, and I think that is such an important point for speaking about kind of the modern era of looking at beauty, because so much, at least from what I see, you know, Paul says that he boasts in his weakness, not because he enjoys the weakness, but because God is glorified in that weakness. And I think we've kind of lost the beauty that we seek now in the modern world, or it seems like the world at large is seeking, is one that is covering up weakness, not exemplifying it, right? Like you have those vases that from ancient Asian cultures where they break them and then they bring them back together with gold, and it exemplifies the weakness, but in such a glorious way.
Yeah.
And instead we're trying to mask.
Yeah.
And so that might be the difference of kind of where we are versus where we need to be. Those artists were projecting their weakness out for other people, not to celebrate necessarily what they were feeling, but to relate to others and to connect. And that's something that's glorious and of God, you know?
Yeah. Edward Hopper is an interesting one for me on this subject, because he's an example of an artist who, in my mind, didn't really come around. He was one of the things that just is so striking about his work is it's very sad and lonely, without intentionally being sad and lonely, you know, like it's scenes of people together, but they're not interacting with each other.
Right.
You know, he'll have a painting of a train car, and at the inside of a train car, and it's just commuters, and they're not interacting with each other, and they're kind of just in this box, and it's sort of a diorama, and we're sort of looking in. And part of the point for him was he lived a pretty miserably lonely existence. And he married a woman who was also a painter and who was more successful of a painter than he was when they first married. And she leveraged her success to get him some visibility. And then he became sort of the celebrity painter of the couple. And she ended up being his business manager and his model. So in a lot of, almost all of the paintings that Hopper did that include a woman, it's her. And she was sort of his muse. And all of the paintings that she's in are really lonely paintings, and vulnerable and kind of cold in some ways. And it's not that Hopper was trying to make some big comment on loneliness. It's that that's how he lived.
Right.
Is he lived in a world that he intentionally kept small, and to be married to him was to also live in this lonely existence that he painted. And so even as he painted her into these paintings where she's just kind of isolated and alone, that was the world that he gave to her in their marriage. And so you look at that and it's a tragedy. Like you see it and you think, oh man, like he, it's not that he was trying to rescue the world from loneliness. He was just trying to show and capture the world that he preferred to live in. Mm-hmm. And so his story is not one of you get to the end and you think, wow, he really had a transformation. And part of the poignancy and the power of his story is you get to the end and it's just so sad. Mm-hmm. You know, you just see it, it just rings so hollow. And his body of work testifies to it over and over and over and over again. And so he's kind of a foil because, you know, you do have painters like Rembrandt where there is a transformation that happens. Mm-hmm. And then you have painters like Hopper where he's so committed to his particular narrative of the world and his existence in it and who he made his wife to be in that world as well. And it never changes. And then he's gone. And the story, the poignancy of the story is how sad it is. for me.
But I think the commonality there, I'm not sure if you'll agree, is that they weren't trying necessarily to, like you said, preach a message to you. They were just trying to reflect their view of things, how the world was.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what's so powerful about it is that's the best he's got. That's his message is here, you know, this is the world.
Yeah.
That's what makes it so powerful to me is that he wasn't trying to preach a message. He was just painting what he knew.
Mm-hmm.
And for human beings, we want to look at it and say, on the one hand, we absolutely relate to the loneliness.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other hand, we wish that the world wasn't that way.
Right.
And it's in that tension that he brings us. Oh, so good.
I think I've always told people, like, when people ask why, you know, some people love people to greater degrees than others. They like to be left alone or they like to interact with people more. I really love people. Mm-hmm. But the reason I love people is because I see in each person this quality of the infinite where, you know, we're all made in the image of God. I think that we have this aspect to us that is just so unfinite, you know? And so when we interact with people, it's not that there's not people that I interact with and I think, wow, I really enjoy your company, and other people I think, we don't seem to get along as well. But each person has that lens, that distinct view of the world that has the potential for beauty if you look for it. And I just think that that's a really good lesson from Hopper, that it's like, it's not that you're looking at his life and thinking, well, you know, here's some grand conclusion that we can all come to at the end. It's just, this is just a person, and yet we can find beauty in the lens that that person projected onto the world for us. I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
So I'd love if you would, we've talked a lot about art and beauty and brokenness, but I would love if you would give our listeners just kind of a walkthrough of some of the excerpts from your book, because I think the methodology that you have here is really, really special. And I think it will, I think when people see what you've done through each artist or each work of art or each story that you bring forward, I think they're really going to be motivated to check out more through your book and also through just art in general. They'll be more willing to interact with that space in the future.
Yeah. So this kind of started when I was invited to speak at a conference and on the subject of art. And immediately I felt like, okay, I have a problem. And the problem is that when you stand up and say, I want to speak to you today about art, people get glazed over almost immediately, mm-hmm. And kind of settle in for what they think is about to happen. And that is some sort of really hard to connect with, esoteric conversation on something that's just going to leave people feeling like, frankly, just for me, leave me feeling dumb, you know, like I don't know enough about this.
Right.
And what I wanted to do was, I was like, no, what I want to tell you is just a really good story. And it'll be about art. And in the process of telling you the story that involves art, you'll learn about the art. But what you'll really learn is a story, and that's what we are drawn to, and that's mm-hmm. and that's part of the way that art works, is we find it in a context. And so I from the time I was in middle school, I had been introduced to Rembrandt's Storm on the Sea of Galilee, and it belonged in the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston. And then in 1990, while I was still in high school, some thieves went into that museum in the middle of the night, the night of St. Patrick's Day, and walked out with 13 works of art, including Rembrandt's Storm on the Sea of Galilee, which they cut out of the frame with a razor, rolled up, and out the door it went, and it hasn't been seen or heard from since. So we're I guess, what, 34 years now after that heist, and that painting is, as the, you know, as they say in law enforcement, it's in the wind. Rembrandt is mm-hmm. in the wind. That's where the title comes from for the book.
Right.
And, but it's a play on words, because in that painting, it's a ship in a storm at sea. It's in the wind. And Rembrandt painted himself into that painting as one of the disciples. He's the 13th disciple in the boat, and he stands between two groups of people. There's one group of disciples who are trying to wake Jesus, and then there's another group of disciples who are trying to keep the ship from sinking, and he is standing there looking dead in the eye at the viewer. So he's holding onto a rope, and he's in a blue robe, and he has his hand on his head holding his hat down, and he's looking at you, and he's looking at me, and he's looking at the thief who cut him out of the frame. And so that's part of the play on words, is he's, Rembrandt is literally in the wind himself in that painting. But I was like, I don't know the story behind this heist, but I want to tell it. And so I started researching, and I learned just a tremendous amount about that particular heist and how these works of art have just vanished, how there are all these kinds of conspiracy theories about it. There's a Netflix special on it. There was a podcast that came out on it, all after I did my initial research into it. And but then it became this story of this woman who built this museum in response to the death of her son and wanting to build something that would never perish. And so she collected, her and her husband, they kind of had limitless money and resources, and they went around the world and they collected all of this. It was a private collection owned by a couple. And they have, you know, a Titian and Rembrandt and Rubens and all these amazing artists from, you know, 400, 500 years ago. And so she put this museum together and said, I'm making something that will never die. And then these thieves come in and they take from it. And one of the conditions of her building this museum in order to make sure that it never was changed or anything is she said, if anything is added to or removed from this permanent collection, the whole thing needs to be liquidated and given to Harvard. And that's the rule. And so when the thieves cut the painting out of the frame, because of that rule, the frame still hangs on the wall of the museum. And so if you go to the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum today, the frame that the Rembrandt painting was in is still on the wall in the same place, because to remove it would activate that clause in the trust that would liquidate the museum. And so you can go, and it's just this eerie sort of encounter with this ghost of a painting that used to be there and now is like, you know, it's got this kind of kind of silk grayish material behind it that just looks eerily like a calm sea. Like the storm is over and the ship is gone and it's just there's nothing there anymore, you know. But those are the kinds of stories that I was like, I want to tell that story. And then when you see that Rembrandt painting, you will think of that painting not just as a fascinating painting, but you'll think of it as one of your paintings, one of the ones you know something about. Van Gogh, there's a chapter on him as well where he only sold one painting when he was alive. And people don't know that. People think, well, he must have, you know, he probably sold a lot of paintings. We know that he struggled, but no, he just sold one while he was alive. And so I got into the story because I didn't know the story. I just knew that he had just sold this one. It's called The Red Vineyard, and it's now in Moscow. So if you want to go see it, you got to get into Russia. So good luck. But it's this beautiful scene that I've always been drawn to, and it's just interesting. It's color, because it's a lot of red and yellow, and not a lot of blue, which is his most common color treatment. But the story behind it is the story of, it's such a great story about Van Gogh as we know him, as somebody who was striving and working so hard in the output of his painting. Like in researching that, you see the volume of paintings he was churning out in the last few years of his life. And in the last 3 months before he died, he was averaging one completed canvas a day for 3 months without fail. And it's manic. You know, it's like the kind of thing that nobody could do. It was a painting a day on average. And so you start to see that story kind of come. What's that?
And still not selling. I mean, it's like this need to continue to create.
Yeah. And also being right on the verge of becoming a household name. And he didn't live to see it. within a year or two of his passing, there were retrospectives on his work all over Europe, and he, by the end of the century, he died in 1890. By the end of the century, he was globally famous. Now, you could argue some of that is because he died, but there's no denying his work. Like, there's right. just no denying Van Gogh's work. Children see Van Gogh paintings and they tell you it's sad. Mm-hmm. Like, and they, well, how do they know that? You know, like, they're looking at a painting of a bridge. Right. And they're like, that's a sad painting. But those are the kinds of things that I'm like, if you can understand some of what goes into the works that we see in museums and the stories behind how they got there, you start to see, oh, there's just a way that human beings move through this world that is filled with all kinds of struggle and sadness and longing for beauty and glory and spending ourselves in trying to, you know, it's the U2 line. I still haven't found what I'm looking for, that there's mm-hmm. this thing that we're after, which is the completeness of God. It's the being at peace in the presence of our Creator that we're looking for. Mm. And so as we start to get into those stories, though, that's what the book is. It's those stories. It's not art history. It's not academic. It's not, I grew up in rural Indiana around farmers, in the countryside, and one of the people, the audience I had in mind as I was writing it is I thought, I want the farmers who live down the street from me, if they were to read this book, to say that those were good stories. Mm-hmm. And because farmers are not people who at least that I grew up with, were not necessarily people who were spending a lot of time in art history, studying art history, but they were also very salt of the earth, focused on things that mattered, storytelling people who were keepers of stories, and understood mm-hmm. that there was beauty even in the work that they did. There was this combination of beauty in their toil, and so I tried to keep them in mind as a way of making sure that I wasn't just that I wasn't going to be writing for academics and I wasn't going to be writing for art snobs, but I was trying to write something for anybody who loves a good story. Mm-hmm. These just happen to be about art,
right? And go ahead.
No, that's it. Yeah.
Well, some of the works you look through are like explicitly faith-based, and others aren't necessarily. But I really like that you bring out that idea that it's not necessarily did this person paint a biblical scene. Mm-hmm. It's what was this person seeking for, and it's the same thing that all of us are seeking for. It's fundamentally human, right? And that makes it fundamentally of God. Mm-hmm. I think that is the. That's the thing that connects people so much to all of this, because whether you are human all of us are human, but if you are human, you can resonate with art, and it, in some way you can resonate with faith, even if you don't ascribe to a certain belief system. It's like we are all in pursuit of this, you know, eternity is in the hearts of man, mm-hmm. and we're all seeking that.
Yeah.
So I think that's really, really cool that you kind of bridge that gap.
Well, some of the artists that do the, you know, the religious art that's in the books were monsters, like the mm-hmm. artists themselves. You know, like I wouldn't want people I love hanging out with Michelangelo for extended periods of time. And Caravaggio, you know, murdered people. Yeah. And yet they gave us some of the more profound works of art dealing with biblical narrative, and it was in the mix. Like, I'm not saying that they were devoid of any kind of spiritual,
right.
But I think what's interesting is some of the. But Edward Hopper, for example, who's a person who had no interest at all in organized religion of any kind, left us with a body of work that communicates a lot of things that are profoundly true about the human condition. In ways that he wasn't intending to communicate Christian truth, but all truth is God's truth, and the truth he was conveying is that we were made to be people who live in community and find fulfillment in being connected to other people without ever having to measure our lives by what we achieve.
Right.
And yet we give ourselves often to those pursuits instead of.
Yeah.
of trusting in the safety and the intentionality of community. And so Yeah, so it's interesting because a lot of the biblical art that we have, the people who made it, you know, it's that adage that you want to be careful about meeting your heroes, you know, like can't be too careful there because their lives are complicated. They're complicated. But for me, that's actually an encouraging part of the story, is to know that like some of the most powerful biblical art that we've got did not necessarily come from the most mature, spiritually mature people. But in fact, came from some of the most broken.
I was really struck by that in your book when you mentioned all the people that put themselves in their paintings and the vantages they chose to place themselves in, you know, like Rembrandt being that in between the disciples kind of person or Caravaggio being the head of Goliath, you know, it's like, man, how do you see yourself? And that's being reflected in the painting as well. I think that's just something that I had never seen before, but or I had never come across before, but it really was one of those things that made me want to dive deeper into the story of the person and the reason.
If you look at older paintings in particular, like Renaissance and things from the 1600s, 1700s, if you ever see in those paintings one of the people in the paintings looking at the viewer, the odds are really good that it's the artist. That he's breaking the fourth wall as a way of connecting what he's trying to show, you know, what he's painting with what he's trying to show you. And so that eye contact is a trick that shows up a lot actually in art, more than you would think anyway.
Right.
So if you ever do see a person in a painting and they're looking at the viewer, look into it and you probably will find that it's a self-portrait.
Yeah. And I love what you said too, going back to that story of Rembrandt and the woman who built that collection of work. And you also mentioned that each person, like when you go through the story of these artists or these artworks, you begin to collect them as pieces, like they are your pieces of art. And it's almost like what she was doing. She was building a work of art without her own creations. You know, it's like creating with things that are already made. And that's really all that people can do in the first place, right? God made things and then we just rearrange it. So there's nothing wrong with that. But I think people that feel that they can't make art don't feel as if they can really appreciate it. And yet you're adding to your collection. You're almost building your own composition, your own body of work, just using other people's, you know, materials. I think that's so cool.
Yeah. And she was pretty overt about that, that her museum was her work of art.
So do you have any, I'll just ask one more question then we'll wrap things up. Do you have any advice for people that, you know, they like this idea, they're hearing what's being said, they think, yeah, I'd love to look into the stories, but you know, you go to an art museum and you might be just overwhelmed. I mean, I've taken people to different art museums in my time and they don't really know where to start. And so they just kind of walk along, they see something they like and they think, that's nice. I can see the beauty of it, but I don't really know how to appreciate what's around me. Do you have any advice for those people?
I do, yes. And this is advice that was given to me by my art teachers and my art teacher in high school in particular. And I love to share this advice because it's borne itself out in my own life. She told us when we were 15-year-olds, she said, if you want to have a lifelong appreciation of art, find an artist that you like, that you connect with for whatever reason, and then just get to know them over the rest of your life. And so, you know, if you like Van Gogh, pay attention to Van Gogh. And when you go to an art museum, go find him. And that's my advice for people visiting art museums is do not attempt to take in the art museum. Go find what you like and start there. And because it's sort of like a phone battery when you go into an art museum where it's just draining, you know, as you're taking things in, and eventually you're going to just be completely out of juice. And I call it getting museum feet, you know, where it feels like your feet are just kind of in blocks of concrete at a certain point. It's because we're whole people. We're made to engage with beauty and splendor. And when you go into an art museum, you are engaging viscerally and not just intellectually with art if you start to look at it at all. And it's an involuntary reaction. It's part of how we're wired, is we're trying to take in things that are profound and meaningful and have in one way or another been deemed worthy enough to hang on the wall of an art museum in a city. and to be preserved in that way. And so you're stepping into something that's going to just assault your senses. Mm-hmm. And so my advice is go find your friends. Go find the people that you know that you're interested in. And what my teacher said, she said that they will introduce you to their colleagues. They will introduce you to their inspirations. Right. They will introduce you to the people who painted next door to them. And so when you go to visit the Impressionists and you go to see Van Gogh, with the post-Impressionists, they're all going to be hanging out together. And so you'll see Van Gogh and you'll say, oh, and you'll read the little plaque next to him and it'll mention how he was thinking about Monet. And Monet's just right there. And so then you look at Monet, and Van Gogh's introducing you to Monet. And then one of the things that you'll see is that Van Gogh was deeply inspired by Rembrandt. Rembrandt's down the hall. And so you'll go down the hall and you'll see Rembrandt and you'll be like, oh, okay, I understand that Rembrandt now is an artist that Van Gogh admired, and a lot of his use of light and dark kind of informed how Van Gogh thought about the application of paint. And then what will Rembrandt do? Well, he'll introduce you around to Vermeer and, you know, other painters who are Dutch, because mm-hmm. That's what Van Gogh and Rembrandt have in common, is one of the things. And so that was the approach, is just, you know, read the little plaques on the wall next to the painting. They're called tombstones. Read the tombstones. And then just do this for the rest of your life. And you'll never run out of things to learn, and it'll be just this wonder. But the way that you learn when you do that is you really, what you're learning is a story.
Right.
So you're kind of defying the art appreciation angle of, well, you have to understand technique and application and, you know, symbolism and all that stuff. And in fact, what you'll do is you'll learn about the technique and the symbolism and all that as you learn about the story.
Right.
And as you learn about the relationships, and as you learn about why they painted what they painted, and what they had to say about the paintings, and what other people had to say about the paintings. And so that's my advice, is when you go to an art museum, find the room where the person or people that you know are in, and go there first.
Mm-hmm.
And spend the energy that you've got taking in the things that you want to see. And as you walk to that room, you will pass things that will catch your eye, and you will say, oh, there's a room of armor, like suits of armor and weaponry from the medieval times. You know, I'd love to go back and check that out. Mm-hmm. And that's a different flavor. You know, it's a different flavor on the flavor wheel. You know, it's,
sure.
But that's what I would say. And if you do that, just know you don't have to take it in. It's a very American idea to think that we should take in an art museum in an afternoon. It's kind of silly. There are paintings in that museum that will take you 6 months of visiting every day just to take the painting in.
Yeah.
So give yourself the grace to say, I'm here to learn and to visit a friend, and they may introduce me to another friend. And then what you build is you build your own kind of collection, paintings that you see and you look at and you think, that's one of mine. And you carry those around with you like you do songs.
Yeah, that's so good. It's like, rather than forcing yourself to appreciate everything, find what you appreciate, and then your appreciation will grow.
Yeah.
Because, you know, so often in the art world, or in anything creative at all, we do have this strange mindset about it. Like, I'll ask people, well, do you paint? And they'll say, no, I don't paint. But if I were to ask a person, well, do you ride a bike? Like, they would never compare themselves to like a world famous Tour de France champion and say, no, I don't ride a bike. It's like, yes, you do ride a bike, right? But they want to compare themselves. And we do the same thing with knowledge. We look at this whole vast world of creative processes and techniques and bodies of work and artists. And we think, it's just too much. I don't get into it. It's like, well, no, did you find something beautiful? Mm-hmm. You know, start there, and then, you know, it grows from there. That's a really good point.
My friend Andrew talks about how, we want to divvy up the world into creatives and non-creatives. And the truth is, we're all creative because we're made in the image of God, who is, by definition, a creator.
Right.
He made us. And so to banish the idea of, well, I'm not a creative. Oh, yeah, you are.
Yeah.
For some people, their creativity comes through in cooking. It comes through in how they parent a child, how they arrange furniture in a room, how they How they care for friendships, you know, that there's artistry, and we're all artists. We're all artists with different things, and we, you know, some people are artists with numbers, you know, and that's right. That's their realm, and find beauty in spreadsheets, and I'm mystified by that, and yet so grateful for it as well. But yeah, I think if we can allow ourselves to understand that I love that image. I've never heard that before. I can ride a bike. That's such a good, I like that. That's really good. Is if we could do that with creativity and say, well, I am a creative person by definition of being a person.
I just want to say thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time. And I want to ask for our viewers, where can they find more of your stuff? Where would you direct them to support you and just find out more about all the things we've talked about today?
Yeah, all of my books are on Amazon, and you can go to the Rabbit Room as well. If you're familiar with the Rabbit Room, rabbitroom.com, you can get my stuff there as well. Really anywhere that sells books, you can find my work. I do have another volume of chapters about art that comes out in October of this year.
Okay.
So it is written and in the editing and publishing process right now, and so I'm really excited for that to come out as well. It's another set of stories that focus more specifically on suffering, it's a new some of the familiar characters show up, Rembrandt and Van Gogh, and then there's a lot of artists that I hadn't touched on yet that make their appearance as well, from Picasso to Norman Rockwell. And a whole host of others that show up. The Hudson River School painters, including Albert Bierstadt, is a fascinating journey into this group of painters that painted these landscape scenes of America before it was settled. It's a really interesting story. So I can't wait for those to come out. So that's coming. So yeah. And I'm just always really grateful and appreciative for anybody who reaches out on social media. I'm on Instagram and Facebook and Twitter, mostly on Instagram. I appreciate anybody who wants to check it out.
Yeah, I love what you've done on Instagram too. It just, for me, someone who appreciates this but doesn't have the years of experience behind it, you zero in on certain things to look at, and you ask really thought-provoking questions. So definitely follow on Instagram. I think that's such a valuable resource.
Yes, thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much again for being on. Thank you for taking the time and for your work in this book. I hope you have a great rest of your day.
Thanks. Thanks. Great to be with you, Micah.
All right. And thank you guys for listening. I appreciate it very much. And I'll see you guys next time.